Just 2 months to go until Election Day. Can you believe it? Can you last that long? We're just about ready for the home stretch on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Donald Trump is still having trouble getting his party establishment behind him. Barry Goldwater had a similar problem in 1964.
He knew exactly what he was doing, and that is to realign the Republican Party's philosophy from moderate liberal to conservative.
Plus, get ready for lots of spending on campaign ads. This wasn't the future envisioned when the McCain-Feingold Act was passed in 2002.
That system has basically collapsed at this point, but I guess we had 4 or 5 good years.
And remember that time the election was so close, it wound up being decided by the Supreme Court?
It was obviously a very long and difficult 36 days filled with a few moments of hope, but ultimately failure and disappointment.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 143 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. I know you miss me. Heck, I even miss me. But we're taking one more week off to catch our breaths from this whirlwind campaign season. And we're making preparations for some great special coverage of the upcoming presidential debates, all the way to the home stretch of this unprecedented election. This week, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite conversations about the politics and process of presidential campaigns. We'll go back to 1964, when Barry Goldwater not only faced off against LBJ, but also had to face up to some opposition within his own party. We'll also look back at the state of the campaign finance reform effort, recalling the 2002 passage of the McCain-Feingold Act, and how some of its ideals have been overturned by the Supreme Court in the years since. And finally, we'll go back to the year 2000 and revisit Bush v. Gore, the controversial Supreme Court decision that ended the closest and one of the most contentious presidential elections of our lifetime. But since we're still away at our secret location, you've got one more week to come up with the answer to our current trivia question, which is, the two major party candidates have nominated a governor and a former governor for vice president. When was the last time that happened in the same year? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll pick a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll be back next week to catch up on the latest political news. Donald Trump secured the Republican nomination for president back in May when he won the Indiana primary, ending the hopes of his last two challengers, Ted Cruz and John Kasich. But even with just 2 months to go until the general election, Trump still doesn't have our United Republican Party behind him. There are quite a few GOP lawmakers and elder statesmen, from Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush to Susan Collins and Ted Cruz, who refuse to back Trump. It's hard to remember the last time when the Republican Party establishment was so leery of its own presidential nominee. You'd have to go back to 1964.
This is another example of his failure to comprehend that being president of the United States is not the same thing as being a benevolent chairman of the board, letting others decide when nuclear destruction shall be unleashed.
That was Bill Scranton, the governor of Pennsylvania. And the person he was talking about was Barry Goldwater, the Republican nominee for president that year. Scranton, Nelson Rockefeller, George Romney, there were a lot of Republicans who refused to back Goldwater. And there was a slew of TV ads.
I've always been a Republican. My father is, his father was. The whole family is a Republican family. I voted for Dwight Eisenhower the first time I ever voted. I voted for Nixon the last time. When we come to Senator Goldwater, now it seems to me we're up against a very different kind of a man. This man scares me.
But are the two situations comparable? The opposition to Trump may be less about ideology and more about crass, misogynistic, and cruel comments he has made in the course of the campaign. With Goldwater, it was more about ideology, a hostile right-wing takeover of a party still run by the Eastern establishment. One person who saw it up close was Barry Goldwater Jr. 26 years old when his father ran for president, Goldwater later served in Congress himself. More impressively, he was once my guest on the Political Junkie segment on NPR's Talk of the Nation. Barry Goldwater, it's great to have you on the show.
Well, Ken, it's always good to see and talk to you. You are an intellect and a keen observer of politics and government. Good to be on your program.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I've seen a lot of, I'm sure you have too, a lot of comparisons to the split in the GOP with Trump now and the way it was with your dad in 1964. How fair do you think those comparisons are?
I got to say that I think there is really no comparison. It looks like it might be comparable, but there really is no comparison. You know, Barry Goldwater, my father, entered public service to make government better. He served the state of Arizona and the nation in the United States Senate for 30 years with great distinction. He was one of the most popular members of the Senate, respected and admired by all his colleagues. He worked, Ken, at least 6 years before the 1964 convention at the grassroots, the precinct level, working with committeemen and county chairmen, helping them to raise money and all the time talking about the conservative philosophy. This silent grassroots takeover of the Republican Party was not hostile. It was gradual, it was thoughtful, and it was convincing. And yes, you had your distractors, as you have now.
Well, you know, I mean, I am on your side on this. I don't think the two situations are comparable at all. And one of the reasons I feel that way is that it just feels like Trump delights in taunting and insulting his fellow Republicans. I don't remember your dad ever doing that.
No, my father was a gentleman. He was kind. He was very sensitive. He cried easily. He had compassion for people, and he was a real patriot. He never talked about himself. He talked about his country, the flag, and his philosophy.
Let's go back to 1963 and 64 for a second. Where was the Republican Party ideologically back then?
Well, back in those days, the Republican Party was controlled mostly by those living on the East. We call it the Eastern Liberal Establishment. It was the more moderate wing of the Republican Party, controlled by Nelson Rockefeller, George Romney, who was governor of Michigan, Bill Scranton, the governor of Pennsylvania. Oh, there were other, Henry Cabot Lodge. There were a number of the Eastern types that pretty well controlled the party.
And when the Rockefellers and the Scrantons and all those of the Romneys who snubbed your dad's candidacy in 64, how did he respond? I mean, was he hurt? Did he hold a grudge? What was his reaction to all that?
Well, I think he took it in stride as being part of politics. He knew exactly what he was doing, and that is to realign the Republican Party's philosophy from moderate liberal to conservative, and so he took that, I think, mostly in stride. I never heard him say anything bad about any of those people that were trying to stop him. He did get quite upset with Milt Romney's father, George, when George was almost violently opposed to my father and would not even support him when my father fairly and squarely won the convention. And they had some letters between each other. I never read any of them, but I understand they were not all that polite.
looking back, I mean, nobody was going to beat Lyndon Johnson back in 64 with the nation in mourning following the assassination of President Kennedy. But how much do you think, or do you think the split in the party, how much, well, let me put it this way, how much do you think the split in the party hurt his candidacy?
Oh, I don't think the split in the party hurt his candidacy. I think his honesty and bluntness probably did more to hurt his candidacy and his personality than did anything else. But I think you're right. The country was not ready for a third president inside of 4 years. Johnson was going to win. My father knew that going in. My father really didn't even want to run. But he ran because he didn't want to let all those new members of the Republican Party who were a follower of the conservative philosophy down. So he went ahead and ran, knowing that he had little chance of winning.
Well, I remember that, of course, prior to those terrible events in Dallas, he was always planning to run against John F. Kennedy. Now, how do you think that race would have turned out?
Well, that's interesting that you brought that up. My father, Senator Goldwater, was a very good friend with John F. Kennedy. And my father used to go down to the White House and sit in the president's rocking chair drinking whiskey. And they hatched up this plan because at the time there was a strong rumor that they were going to oppose each other. They hatched up a plan where they would run together, get on one airplane and hopscotch around the country, and much like Lincoln-Douglas debates, debate each other. And they had that all pretty well planned out. And then, of course, when the president was assassinated, those plans fell away, and my father was very depressed over what happened to his friend John F. Kennedy.
You know, just before when you were talking about the fact that your father would say these things that were on his mind, I was thinking of that famous quote where he said that there was some talk about nuclear weapons, and he said he'd love to lob one into the men's room in the Kremlin. Now, of course, he was joking, and a lot of people thought that was funny, but there were also a lot of people who were just horrified by a comment like that.
Yeah, well, my father had a sense of humor, and he did say that. He also suggested that because of the liberalists of the East Coast, that we somehow saw off the East Coast. I think he advocated one time making TVA private instead of a government run. But he was very blunt, and he was an interesting copy. The press loved him because he always had something funny or something to copy.
You know, his slogan that year was, of course, "In your heart, you know he's right." And he had that famous line at the convention about extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. So, I mean, he was a true-bred conservative through and through. How do you think your dad would have responded to a Donald Trump candidacy?
Well, his opponents also said to that slogan, "In your gut, you know he's nuts."
Yeah, I have that button, right.
You have that button?
I sure do.
Campaigns are fun. They bring out the best and the worst, I think. You know, I think the difference between Goldwater and Trump is that Goldwater believed in something, and you knew what he believed in. He redefined the Republican Party as a party of conservatives, and he defined conservatism as that it was based on the laws of nature and God, that conservatism is not an economic theory. And he truly believed that this country was developed from individual initiative and ambition. And to regard man and treat them as if they are all the same is to consign them to ultimate slavery. He went on to say in his best-selling book, Conscience of a Conservative, "We have a right to our liberty, our freedom, as guaranteed by the Constitution." And Ken, he believed that, and he spoke about that. People knew what he stood for, and they knew all about him. And the difference between he and Trump is that Trump, you don't really know what he believes in. I've yet to hear a philosophical discussion by him about where he's coming from. And so that's one big difference.
You know, just one final thought. Even though your father did get creamed in 64, there are a lot of conservatives who said that was the true beginning of the conservative movement, and it led to, ultimately led to, Ronald Reagan.
Well, and I think 7 or 8 presidents out of the next 10 were Republican. So the conservative movement was launched back in 64, and it has proven to be pretty successful.
Barry Goldwater Jr. is the son of the 1964 Republican presidential nominee and a former member of Congress in his own right. He serves on the board of directors of the Goldwater Institute, a conservative think tank. Barry, it's great to hear your voice again, and it's great to have you on the program.
Ken, anytime. You're always a lot of fun to be with.
In your heart, you know he's right.
So go, Goldwater. Let's go, Goldwater. Let's go, Goldwater all the way. Just make a note to cast your vote for Mr. USA.
As the 2016 election heads into its final weeks, you can expect to see many more campaign ads flooding the airwaves, especially in swing states. Today, billions of dollars are spent on political ads during the presidential campaign season, not just by the official campaigns, but also by independent expenditure committees, also commonly known as super PACs. The debate over the issue of overhauling America's campaign finance system has been going on for years, decades even. In the wake of the abuses discovered during the Watergate scandal, there has been an ongoing effort to limit or regulate the amount of money that goes into campaigns. In 2002, the campaign finance reform effort came closer than ever. Democrats had taken control of the Senate, and they went on to pass what was known as the McCain-Feingold Act by a 60-40 vote. President Bush signed the act into law a week later. Here was John McCain after the act's passage.
What we've really done is for a couple of hundred million Americans is to give them the opportunity to be heard again here in our nation's capital as we pass laws and policies and rules and regulation that affect their daily lives. They've been rendered silent by the influence of the big money that we all know about, which has been authenticated time after time. And a record that in recent years has been marred by scandals which make many of us ashamed and embarrassed. So on behalf of all Americans who will have a greater voice now, I thank you for your support, all of our friends here behind us. And once again, I think Americans will be heard and proud of their elected officials. Thank you.
Larry Noble is the general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center. Before that, he was president and CEO of Americans for Campaign Reform, executive director and general counsel of the Center for Responsive Politics, and served as the general counsel of the Federal Election Commission for 13 years. Larry, it's great to have you back on The Political Junkie.
Great to be here, Ken.
Larry, you just heard Senator McCain. The vote would make Americans proud of their elected officials. There was great optimism when that bill was passed, wasn't there?
There was great optimism. It was the first major reform since the Federal Election Campaign Act was passed in 74. It was aimed at dealing with what was called then the soft money problem, and we had just come out of a major scandal that actually lasted several years. So there was real optimism about it.
So in the years leading up to 2002, there had been many efforts made. Why did they always fail?
Well, the traditional wisdom is the Republicans are opposed to campaign finance reform, but so are a lot of Democrats. It failed because there was this bipartisan opposition to it because nobody wants to give up the way they've been getting elected, which is with the money. And though Democrats officially did support it, in the end were the ones who voted for it. But even when they were voting for it in 2002, there were Democrats going around saying, this is going to be the death of the party. We shouldn't do this. So it's always been this strange kind of law that nobody is really loved in the political parties. But I think now, you know, people realize the problems when you don't have these type of laws.
The person I always think of during those failed efforts was Mitch McConnell, because he had been battling campaign finance laws for years, saying unconstitutional, that money equals free speech. It was basically McConnell that really filibustered that bill for so many years.
Yes, McConnell has been a longstanding opponent of campaign finance laws, though he at one time said he was in favor of disclosure. He's no longer in favor of disclosure. I remember he was quoted one time as saying that nobody's ever lost an election for voting against campaign finance laws. And his position was that they were unconstitutional and they were wrong. And so to this day, he's opposed to them.
Well, that's a good question. Can you think of any candidate who suffered because of opposition to campaign finance reform?
It's a good question, and it's hard to tell. Obviously, it's hard to tell why somebody loses, and there haven't been that many that have made it the forefront of their campaigns until recently. And I think what's happened with Bernie Sanders has been the opposite of that, is that I think a lot of his support, though doesn't necessarily look like he's going to succeed, but a lot of his support has come from his stand on campaign finance and money in politics. So I think it's growing in the public consciousness.
You mentioned that when reforms are attempted, it's usually in the middle of a scandal. Talk a little bit about the Enron scandal going on in 2002.
Right. So the McCain-Feingold bill, what became known as McCain-Feingold, or Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, had actually been around for a while. And there had been efforts before to pass it, and they had failed. The Senate held hearings in, I think it was 1998, on the soft money scandal. And then you had the Enron scandal. And the Enron scandal was basically about a company that turned out its books were fraudulent. And it was, I think at the time, the largest bankruptcy in the country. And when they started investigating what happened, it also brought down an accounting firm that basically they were cooking the books. Nobody was talking about it. And people started asking, how can you get away with this? And then there were those, and I have to say our group at the time, Center Responsive Politics, was one of them, who started looking at campaign contributions and made the connection between who these people were supporting, the Enron executives were supporting, and the lack of support for reform over audits of companies like this and things that allowed this type of abuse to come on. So the connection was made in the public's mind between Enron. There was also WorldCom. There were other companies that were doing this. And it became a campaign finance reform scandal. And I think that pushed it over the top.
And they were giving to both parties, weren't they?
They were giving to both parties. And that's traditional. Traditionally, what you see is they give to both parties, and it takes both parties often to block legislation. And it's not the legislation necessarily that they get passed. It's a legislation that never gets passed because of the contributions they're giving.
And I remember at the time hearing that one of the reasons President Bush did not fight this bill is because he was also one of the recipients to Enron contributions.
Right. And it was interesting because when Clinton was in the White House, the bill never passed. And even when the Democrats had the presidency and the Senate and the House, it didn't pass for some reason. But when Bush was in the White House, because of the scandal, because I think he was afraid to be tainted by the scandal, he wasn't enthusiastic about it, but he did sign it. He did not stand in the way. And so there were enough Democrats and some Republicans, and the bill did get over. And they had enough, actually, to avoid a filibuster.
They passed a bill 14 years ago this week, and basically now all these money problems of politics have been solved, right?
Right. No, it's perfect. We have a perfect system now, and it all works. No, what happened, actually, the law was pretty broad. So what it did was banned soft money, which is unregulated money going to the political parties. It banned federal office holders from raising soft money. It did a number of other things. And it was
the negative ads, too, right? Those issue ads.
Right. So, right. Yeah. So what it did was these prior to McCain-Feingold, it was everybody thought that the only ads that you could regulate were ads that contained what was called express advocacy, vote for the candidate, elect the candidate. But most of the political ads don't contain that type of action. They just say, Joe Smith is terrible, he beats his wife, you know, he robs banks, call him and tell him you don't want him to be that way. And they say, well, that's not a political ad. McCain-Feingold broadened the definition of political ad to take in basically ads that mention a candidate right before an election. As I say, it banned soft money solicitation. It was very broad. And surprising to many, the Supreme Court upheld it. Almost every provision of it, it upheld. And it talked about corruption. It talked about the scandals. And so you had a new law that was very, very broad. It worked for a while. It did. But two things happened, which tend to happen in these things. One is the FEC started to write loopholes in the law immediately and started to narrow the law. And that caused serious problems. And actually, our organization, Campaign Legal Center, is still in litigation with the FEC over rules stemming from that law. And then the second big thing that happened was a change in the Supreme Court. And that gave us Citizens United.
2010.
And that the system has basically collapsed at this point. But I guess we had 4 or 5 good years.
Talk to me about Citizens United. That was a 5-4 decision, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a 5-4 decision.
And it was in 2010.
Right.
Tell me what it changed.
Citizens United itself, actually, I personally believe, changed in some ways more the psychology than the actual law, because the law had been evolving. There was a case, Wisconsin Right to Life. As soon as Roberts basically took over, the law had been evolving or devolving. What it changed was the first time it allowed corporations and labor unions, presumably, to make what are called independent expenditures. And these are the expenditures that attack candidates or expressly advocate the defeat of candidates, but are not coordinated with a candidate. And it said individuals have been able to make those since Buckley in 1976. It said corporations and labor unions have the same rights as individuals. And that got a lot of people, understandably, very upset. It was a 5-4 decision. Shortly after that, the D.C. Court of Appeals ruled on a case called Speech Now, which sanctioned super PACs, what are now called super PACs. They said if a corporation can spend this money independently, it can give it to a political action committee, unlimited amount of money, and that political action committee can spend it independently. And that is why today we have all these super PACs, which have basically become auxiliary arms of the campaigns.
And then in 2014, the court ruled on McCutcheon, also a 5-4 decision,
yes.
I think. And what did that do?
Well, there were what were called aggregate limits. We have contribution limits on what an individual can give to a candidate and also what they can give to a political party. There were also what were called aggregate limits, which is the amount an individual can give overall in a 2-year election cycle. So originally it was around $125,000. So adding up all the candidates you give to, the parties you give to, and the federal level, you can't give more than that amount. The Supreme Court struck down the aggregate limits and said that you could have individual contribution limits to what you give to candidates and parties, but not an overall limit. Interestingly, around the same time, the FEC gave the party committees an additional limit to what they previously had, and then Congress gave them two more limits. So they basically tripled the amount of money an individual can give to the political parties, and there's no limit overall of what you can give to all federal candidates and parties.
Who knows what's going to happen in November, but let's just say the Democrats keep the White House and maybe even take the Senate, who knows. But if that happens, we could very well have a liberal majority on the Supreme Court for the first time in decades, a court that would see campaign finance laws differently. What could happen?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, so there are a lot of us working on what kind of the strategy going forward if we get that. First thing, could happen is overturning Speech Now, which is the D.C. Circuit case, or bringing that up to the Supreme Court, the issue up to the Supreme Court, and saying that super PACs can be limited. Overturning Citizens United. But even there's a more ambitious agenda, which is going back to the McConnell days of a broader conception of corruption. See, one of the problems that happened with Citizens United is not so much the ruling, but how it got there. And this is also true of McCutcheon, which is it narrowed the definition of corruption, the type of thing the government can try to prevent, to quid pro quo corruption, the actual giving something for the money. It rejected what the court had said to McConnell, that you also have corruption when you can buy access, you buy influence, even though there's not a specific vote you're buying.
Right.
And so there'll be attempts to broaden back the definition of corruption, bring it back, and to expand on the laws. Then what it takes is Congress to pass new laws. Actually, more of the activity is going on in the states now than at the federal level. But, if we have a Republican House, which I assume we probably still will, it may be very hard to get laws passed. Though I have to tell you, there are Republicans who quietly support reform. The problem is they like their seats. They like, they don't want to get beaten up. And so some of them are reluctant. Not all of them. Some of them are reluctant to come forward.
It's like chickens voting for Colonel Sanders. Why would they do that? Right.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. So do you think that the prospect for change, if there is a prospect for change, will take place more in the courts than in Congress?
Initially, I think it'll take place more in the courts. And I think the courts will broaden what the government interests, what the government can actually regulate. And at the same time, we need to get laws passed in Congress and also at the state. There are a lot of ballot measures now that are really broadening the laws. And the reason I say they're being done by ballot measures is, again, it's hard to get the state legislature to do it. So the voters are doing it, and including small donor public funding. And there are proposals in Congress for this. But I think it's one of these issues that, and whether it takes a scandal or not, the public has to demand it. And I think if the public demands it, it'll happen.
Larry Noble is the general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center and an expert on campaign finance legislation. Larry, it's great having you on the program.
It's my pleasure. Always enjoy it.
Most weeks on the show, I serve up a political trivia question for you to solve. You email in your answers, and I pick one correct response at random to win a vintage Political Junkie button. But every once in a while, my trivia questions can spark up some interesting conversations. That was the case back in March of last year when I asked this question. Who is the last president who went undefeated in his political career? By that, I meant general elections as well as contested primaries. That question caught the eye of a friend of the show, Aaron Blake of the Washington Post. He wrote up a blog post called, "All of Our Recent Presidents Have Been Losers." But he came up with a different answer to the trivia question because he missed the fine print, general elections and contested primaries. And so I invited him back to the show to discuss the correct answer and, more important, to heap some abuse on him. You're a brave man, Aaron Blake.
I'm girding for what's to come here. I cannot possibly be prepared, but I'm girding.
The thing is, I have no idea either, and that's what makes it fun. Okay, so let's talk about all the presidents since. The current president is, as you well know, Barack Obama, and he lost the election in his career, right?
2000 to Congressman Bobby Rush,
right.
An ill-advised primary challenge that he lost by 29 points.
Exactly. Then George W. Bush, his predecessor, he lost a race for Congress too.
Yeah, I believe it was in 1978
that
was
is correct.
His first race for
that
Congress.
Do you remember who he lost to?
See, now that I cannot remember.
Kent Hance.
Okay.
And Bill Clinton, his predecessor?
Bill Clinton lost actually two races,
that's
a race
right.
for Congress in 1974.
Right. Do you remember who he lost to? John Paul Hammerschmidt.
Okay. That's a great name for a congressman, right?
Right. He was actually related to John Jacob Jingle Hammerschmidt. Very few people know that. And then he also lost again re-election to as governor, right?
Yeah, back in the days when Arkansas had 2-year terms for governors,
right.
He won in 78 and then lost his re-election campaign in 1980.
That's correct.
And of course, some good things happened in the years to come after that.
That's right. And the guy before him was George H.W. Bush. Now, of course, he lost his re-election to Bill Clinton, but he also lost bids for the Senate, right?
He lost two campaigns for the same seat in 1964 and 1970. The first time, I believe, was to Senator Yarbrough.
That's correct, Ralph Yarbrough.
And the second time he was lining up to run against Yarbrough, but Yarbrough actually lost the primary. And I want to say, was it to Benson?
It was Lloyd Benson. That's exactly right.
So, I wrote this piece a couple days ago, and now you're quizzing me on all the details, and I can't quite remember everything, but I seem to be pulling a few things out here. So two presidents who had two losses before their presidency started.
Well, Aaron, you don't have nothing to worry about. You've proven yourself very worthy to be on this show, and I think this show is going to make your career.
I'm really hoping that that's the case. It's why I keep coming on.
Exactly. Okay, so before George W. Bush, there was George H.W. Bush, there was Ronald Reagan, and while he never lost in California, he did lose primaries, didn't he?
Right. I think we can give somebody a pass for maybe losing a presidential campaign. There's a lot of presidents who have lost a presidential campaign or who won and wound up losing their reelection campaign. So I think, if anything, Ronald Reagan deserves a little star next to his name when it comes to this list.
He does, but when he ran against Ford in the 1976 primaries, he lost a lot of them, including New Hampshire. And, of course, remember in the beginning we said, as well as contested primaries. And so that knocks Reagan out. And his predecessor, of course, was Jimmy Carter.
Who lost an earlier bid for governor of Georgia when he was a little-known state senator. He actually finished third in the primary. I believe it was in 1966.
It was. That was the election won by the Honorable Lester Maddox.
Right. So he didn't even make the top two in the primary, and that was just 4 years before he wound up becoming governor. So another case where I think losing a campaign wound up being a good thing for the guy.
Right, although he also lost to Ronald Reagan for re-election in 1980. And the guy Carter beat for president, of course, was Gerald Ford.
Right, who, of course, lost the re-election race after becoming a non-elected president. But that was also his only loss in his career. Of course, a long career in Congress before being picked for vice president, replacing Spiro Agnew in that role.
And before Gerald Ford was Richard Nixon, and we know about his famous losses back-to-back, right?
You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore, which is not what he said. Some people think he said that after the 1960 presidential race that he lost. It was actually after he lost the governor's race in California 2 years later. It turned out they did have Nixon to kick around a little bit more after that.
He lost to JFK in 60 and Pat Brown in 62. And before Richard Nixon was Lyndon Johnson, and he has an early loss in his career as well.
Right. And the point I make in the piece is he arguably had two losses. He lost the 1941 special election for U.S. Senate. He ran for the Senate again in 1948. And while technically won and he served out his term in the Senate, his time in the Senate, rather, things have come to light since then that suggest maybe that wasn't entirely on the up and up. There may have been some ballot stuffing involved. It was an extremely close race. So
they called him Landslide Lyndon.
Yeah, exactly. Landslide. There may be some other nicknames that could come out of that election that we've learned since then.
And as long as we have you on this subject, in 1941, when he ran for the Senate, there's a picture button that says "Me and Roosevelt" for Lyndon Johnson. It's a picture of FDR and LBJ on the same campaign button. It's a button that I desperately want in my collection. And Aaron, when we get off the phone, can you find it for me? Because I really want that button.
They got to have it on eBay somewhere, right?
No, they don't.
Maybe we can put out a call out for the Fix readers to send one over to Ken Rudin, because I think this is important.
I think I deserve that. So right before Lyndon Johnson was John Kennedy. Now, here's where you and I disagree. I mean, Kennedy was elected to 3 terms in the House, 2 in the Senate, and of course, when he ran for president in 1960, he did not lose a contested primary. But you say Kennedy should be the answer because something that happened in 1956.
Right. So when I was responding to the trivia question, I hadn't seen the particulars of it. I only saw the tweet that you put out. So I didn't know kind of what the parameters of it were. Kennedy actually lost the 1956 nomination for vice president. Of course, this was back when conventions actually decided things, and Adlai Stevenson was looking for the convention to decide his VP nominee. So there was actually a race for it, and Kennedy finished second.
Stevenson couldn't decide his own VP, so he left it up to the delegates at the 56th convention. Right?
Isn't that amazing to think that would have happened? That would never happen today, right?
No, it would not happen today. but again, that was not. I don't mean to be anti-semantic, but that was not a general election or a primary.
According to the terms that I've since learned, the terms of the question you were asking, I agree wholeheartedly. You are correct. You are right. I am wrong. Ken Rudin is, again, the political champion.
Oh, I love that you say that. So that means that leaves Steve Martin of Vernon Hills, Illinois, as this week's winner. Steve, not Aaron, gets the coveted political junkie button.
But yeah, also, Aaron, a great banjo player, Steve is, I hear.
Yes, I've heard that, yes. Aaron, although the good news is always next week, and besides, you have that museum on the mall named after you, right?
I do? What's the museum on the mall?
Yeah, the Aaron Space Museum.
Oh, gosh. Ken, you're not actually going to have this on the podcast, are you?
Aaron Blake is a political junkie. He's a political junkie. He's a political reporter for The Washington Post and can be found on Twitter at AaronBlakeWP. Aaron, it was a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for putting up with these funny jokes.
Thank you. I am duly chastened, I will tell you that.
As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, scuttle button puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and more. It's at krpoliticaljunkie.com. The 2000 presidential race was one of the closest in American history. But the networks were able to call it on election night, especially when they thought Vice President Al Gore defeated Governor George W. Bush in Florida. Here's NBC's Tom Brokaw.
We're going to now project an important win for Vice President Al Gore. NBC News projects that he wins the 25 electoral votes in the state of Florida. It turns out that Governor Jeb Bush was not his brother's keeper. The family had been joking and seriously that it could be a cold Thanksgiving.
That call didn't last long.
What the networks give us, the networks taketh away. NBC News is now taking Florida out of Vice President Gore's column and putting it back in the too close to call column.
Later that evening, Brokaw interrupted Doris Kearns Goodwin with some breaking news.
Oh, well, there's no question that in a time of peace and prosperity like this, it's possible
stop,
for the country to
stop.
Have such
Doris,
a division
Doris,
as
Doris,
they do.
Doris, Doris, Doris.
Uh-oh, something's happened.
George Bush is the president-elect of the United States. He has won the state of Florida, according to our projections. 25 electoral votes. NBC News projects that George Bush, it's been a night of first giving it to Al Gore, then taking it away on the part of the networks. George Walker Bush, the new president of the United States.
Not long afterwards, there was a Gore concession, and then there wasn't.
All right, we're officially saying that Florida is too close to call because of a recall. Campaign and voter counters are being called back to work to count absentee ballots. So we take Florida away from George W. Bush. That means he is short of the 270 electoral votes that he needs to win.
After a mandatory machine recount, Bush's lead in the state had slipped from nearly 1,800 to 327 out of some 6 million votes cast. What followed was weeks of partial recounts, Florida court decisions that went both ways, and partisan back and forth until the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, halted the statewide recount. It left Bush with a 537-vote lead, and it made him the 43rd president of the United States. Ron Klain was the chief of staff to Vice President Gore from 1995 to 1999, and in 2000 served as general counsel for Gore's recount effort in Florida. He was also the chief of staff of Vice President Joe Biden, and more recently, served as President Obama's Ebola czar. Ron Klain, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Before we even get to the 2000 election, talk for a little bit about Gore getting picked by Clinton to be his running mate. When you think of reasons why tickets are put together, geographical, ideological, age issues, in this one, the script was completely thrown out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a new script, and I think, frankly, it's a script that's held ever since then, which discards the more traditional hackneyed ticket balancing considerations of I'm from the North, you're from the South, I'm old, you're young, or something like that, and looks first and foremost at picking someone who the president thinks would be a great president if the vice president had to step in and take over, and whom the president thinks could be a good partner in trying to achieve his agenda as president, who the president wants to entrust responsibility and substantial duties to. And so, you know, I think that when you look at, again, not a vice president I approve of, but you look at the choice that Bush made of Cheney, and then, of course, more recently, Obama made of Biden. I think it's all of a trend that really began with the selection of Al Gore to be Bill Clinton's running mate.
What was Gore's role as vice president? How important of a role did he play in his 8 years?
Well, he had a very significant role as vice president. He took substantial parts of business that the president gave him to run for all 8 years, particularly environmental policy and technology policy. You know, we're about to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Telecom Act of 1996. Vice President Gore, which paved the way for what we call the Internet today, really paved the way for the commercialization of the Internet, put in place the policies that led to the Internet. Vice President Gore oversaw the administration's formulation of its position on that, helped get it through the Congress as sitting vice president. His work on environmental policy was well known and famous. He also ran the Reinventing Government Initiative to try to reform the way government worked and handled a number of important bilateral foreign policy relationships with Russia and South Africa in particular. So he had a very, very full plate, a very influential role in the administration.
I always think of Hubert Humphrey's torturous relationship with Lyndon Johnson when he ran for president in 68, wanting to support him, but wanting to break from him on the war. Now, I wouldn't call Gore's relationship with Clinton torturous, not at all, but how much was Gore conflicted over Clinton's behavior issues, for lack of a better term?
I think it's been well reported that there was a certain amount of tension between the president and the vice president on this, and the vice president definitely wanted to try to make his views and feelings on this known. I think the situation was what it was, and I think the vice president tried to handle it as fairly and deftly as he could.
Well, then came Election Day 2000, when he received the most votes for president, but lost in the Electoral College when the Supreme Court ended the recount in Florida and gave the state in the election to George W. Bush. So speaking of torturous, that recount process must have been torture.
Well, it was. I mean, it was obviously a very long and difficult 36 days filled with a few moments of hope, but ultimately failure and disappointment. You know, I still believe that Vice President Gore got the most votes in Florida, and that a fair recount would have shown that, and that the decision by the Supreme Court to stop the recount midway was never well justified and can't be defended. But, you know, we fought the best we could. I do think ultimately the what-ifs are just overwhelming. If we had won New Hampshire, which we lost by only 5,000 votes, Vice President Gore would have won in the Electoral College even without Florida. And in the last few weeks of the campaign, we never went to New Hampshire because it was such a small state. You know, the Vice President spent his time in the larger states. But what if we had gone to New Hampshire? What if we campaigned harder there? You know, what if we could just have gotten a few more votes in Florida and not really had it result in a recount? You know, just an election that close, there's so many what-ifs, and it's just really hard to look back on it and think about that.
537 votes. I mean, everybody talks about what if Ralph Nader didn't run? What if you won West Virginia or Tennessee? But 537 votes deciding a presidency is just, it's remarkable.
It is remarkable. I mean, I think my view is that we got more votes and we're kind of gypped out of it. But even under that view, my view, we won Florida by a few thousand votes out of 6 million cast down there. I mean, it was an astonishingly, painfully close election. And, you know, we may never see an election that close again. It was virtually a coin flip in Florida one way or the other.
There was also an HBO movie based on the process called Recount. And some guy named Ron Klain was the main character, and he was played by Kevin Spacey. How difficult was it for you to go through that agony all over again to watch that movie?
Well, I mean, I think that it's a dramatization. It's not a documentary, but a very effective one. And it was painful to watch, but I hope it came out 8 years afterwards. I hope it reminded folks of what happened in Florida. Like, it is obviously painful for me to think about it, but I'm happy to talk about it because I hope people learn the lessons from it. One, that, you know, it's important for people to vote, and voting does make a difference. And it's hard to believe your vote actually matters in a presidential campaign, but it can. 537 votes out of 6 million in Florida made a huge difference. Two, that our voting system is unfair, that it doesn't fairly count the votes of people of color, of poor people, of people in urban communities. And we need to continue to improve our electoral system, improve the mechanics of our electoral system to make sure that the people who go and cast the votes get counted. And three, you know, we need to make sure that efforts to suppress the vote, efforts to wrongfully remove people from the rolls, which a lot have happened in Florida in 2000, are stopped and reversed. And any telling of the story, any illumination on that, that brings those themes to light and that makes people aware of that is something that I'm very supportive of.
So much has happened since that election. 9/11, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The whole world has changed. Do you ever think of what would have been different had the court ruled the other way and Gore had won?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's hard not to think about that. The journalist Jeff Greenfield wrote a book on historical what ifs, and then did a separate chapter on what if Gore had won the recount. And, you know, given the consequences of that outcome, the two wars, the tax cuts, the deficit, all these things, it's hard not to think about the what if. You know, someone wrote a piece the other day I read where they said, well, if Gore hadn't lost, Bush wouldn't have been president. If Bush hadn't been president, there wouldn't have been the backlash against him in 2006 and ultimately in 2008, which brought in large Democratic majorities. You wouldn't have had Obamacare pass in 2009 without those Democratic majorities. You wouldn't have had Obama maybe get elected president. So you can play the what-if game, I suppose, in an infinity way. I spend less time thinking about the what-ifs and more about how we need to make sure that what happened in 2000 doesn't happen again. We make sure that people who come to the polls who have the right to vote get their votes cast. We make sure people get to the polls. We make sure that their votes are tabulated fairly and accurately. That's the part going forward we can control, and I think that's the part that I hope people take away from that election.
You realize that when you were talking about what ifs, I mean, had Gore won the election, there would have been no reason for you to have been on the Political Junkie program.
Well, there you go. So I guess all's well that ends well.
Ron Klain is the former chief of staff to Vice President Al Gore. Ron, thank you so much for sharing your memories.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ken.
On December 12, 2000, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered a halt in the recount of the presidential race, essentially making George W. Bush the president-elect. The day after the ruling, Al Gore conceded the race for good.
Good evening. Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States. And I promised him that I wouldn't call him back this time. What remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country. Now the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken. Let there be no doubt, while I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it. I accept the finality of this outcome, which will be ratified next Monday in the Electoral College. And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession.
It's over, it's over, it's over. It's over.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.